Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined, as always, in studio by my good friend and my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, we are sans the hardest resting man in ministry, Ronald J. Martin, who is where he needs to be again, which is traveling and unavailable for the program. But we've got kind of a somber one on tap, Pipe, in that a day ago, we're taping this on a Monday. Kobe Bryant, NBA legend, passed away in a helicopter accident. He was 41 years old. And we're going to talk about all aspects of that. But first, Pipe, why don't you tell us about our sponsor, Dwell Bible?
Yeah, so Dwell has been a partner of ours for several months now, and we have loved we've loved having them sponsor the podcast. We especially love having sponsors whose products we use and enjoy, and Dwell is one of those. It is an audio Bible app, so if you go to dwellapp.io/happyrant, or just go to Happy Rant, you just go to our show notes. You'll see it all there, but again, dwellapp.io/happyrant. You can find out all about the app. They have listening plans. They have multiple narrators. They have new features coming out all the time. And so that includes like sort of a clip and save feature, or it's, you know, you can select a segment and listen to it on repeat for memorization or for study. It's a great way to use time in the car or time at the gym, or, you know, anytime you'd be listening to a podcast like this one or an audiobook, you can drop Dwell into some of that time and sort of get more scripture into your life. I find it helpful just because, you know, life is full and sometimes it's hard to get in the word. But again, dwellapp.io/happyrant, and the offer they have for listeners, you can also share this with anybody, is a 33% discount off of the subscription. So that's, it ends up being less than $20 a year. So really inexpensive, less than $2 a month to have access to this whole wealth of scripture audio that they are improving and increasing all the time. So go check that out.
Awesome. Thank you, Pipe. And thank you to Dwell for partnering with us. And thank you to our listeners. It's been a long time since I've thanked our fan base here at the Happy Rant. And we've been doing this for a long time, Piper, and enjoying it for a long time, gearing up for another live show in Louisville later this spring. And yeah, just grateful
that
people. I think
this year makes 6 years. I think I feel like it was spring of 14 that we started this joint.
Yeah, it's wild, man. This is my fifth year at Union. So, and we started this about a year before I moved down here. So yeah, it would be year six, which is crazy. A lot's changed, man. A lot's changed in the world. A lot's changed in our lives. But it's been fun to keep doing this, and it's always fun to me, man, to have interactions with people and fans and people who listen to the show who pop up here and there and send us stuff. And, it is a reminder of what a privilege it is to have an audience, you know, any audience of any size, you know, caring about what you do. It's kind of a big deal. And in that light, you know, Kobe Bryant had a huge audience, and it's interesting, Pipe, and I want to hear your story of kind of how you got the news yesterday. But we had this morning where it was just a great morning. It was a great morning of, you know, for me, spending time with my wife, just enjoying Red Bud coffee and, you know, enjoying each other, going to church, being super grateful. I think even more grateful than usual of what a blessing we have in our church. And then, you know, came home, had lunch with a friend. And then I started getting these texts from my students, and in particular, basketball players. You know, I think we're especially wrecked by the news of Kobe's death. And then, you know, for the Christian, I think just the reminder of death in the world. You know, we had this kind of celebratory morning of hopefulness and life with our church, and then just to be reminded that when someone dies young, it's brokenness. You know, it's brokenness in the world. I think it's especially hard when a non-believer dies, to be honest. You know, there's no way to sort of hopefully talk about that with your kids or with anyone, you know, and it hits especially hard. So, so yeah, just kind of, it cast a pall over yesterday and today. And, people are obviously responding to it in very current ways, I guess I'll say. And, you know, and there's some sadness in that too, but what about your experience with it, Pipe?
Yeah, really similar morning. You know, got up and went to church, and just a full morning of really, you know, good conversations with people at church and a great message. Sam Albury preached at our church, and you use the term sort of grateful and celebratory, and I think both of those sum up the experience all the way up to going to lunch with my kids after church. And I think it was so after lunch, I took my kids out to lunch afterwards, and then was on my way with them to go run a quick errand. And was waiting at a red light, and as one does, pulled up Twitter, because I'm addicted to my phone, like the rest of America, except for you. You're not addicted to Twitter. And I see a TMZ report shared that there's a report that Kobe Bryant dies in a helicopter crash. Well, there was nothing else on it. Google didn't have anything. No other reporters were saying anything. And my first thought was just, I hope to everything that this is fake.
Sure.
Absolutely. I mean, and TMZ is kind of a gong show, but they're good reporters. Like they have really good sources. And so I was really scared. And so I go into the store with my kids. I come out 15 minutes later, and now Twitter has blown up, but there's not a lot of verification on it. And then there's a report that all of his kids are in the helicopter with him. And that was from a reporter at ABC.
Yeah, so, I saw that. Story.
Which is terrible. I mean, it would have been terrible if it was true. It is also terrible that it was reported. And we're driving 30 minutes home from lunch and church and errands, and I'm just sort of trying to keep my head in the car with my kids, but also wondering what's going on. I get home, I look through it all, to try to find out what's going on. By that time, it's sort of been shaken out that no, all of his kids were not in there, but his 13-year-old daughter was. He was confirmed killed in this helicopter crash. I guess they were on their way to an AAU game or something. And there was, I haven't seen reported much is anything about the other people in the helicopter. Cause I think there was another family and at least one or two of, I think his daughter's name is Gianna, her teammates. And so, I mean, it's hit a lot of families, but I think the thing that hit me most was not famous person got killed, but 13-year-old daughter got killed with
him.
I'm in the car with my recently turned 14-year-old daughter and my recently turned 11-year-old daughters. And if we lived in a different neighborhood, this could have been their friend. This is the same people they have on their swim teams or they go to youth group with or whatever. It's the exact same kind of kid. And, I think that more than anything has landed heavily on me. And then starting to see the responses to Kobe's passing. And to me, Kobe was always he's a premier basketball player, but I never had any emotional connection to Kobe. He wasn't an athlete who I loved. I came of age during the Jordan era.
Yeah.
And then my favorite players and teams were always opposed to Kobe. So he was always a guy I really disliked as a basketball player. Respected completely. But to see how, you mentioned all the basketball players texting you. He was formational. I don't even know if that's a word, but let's call it one. For a whole generation of basketball players post Jordan and pre LeBron.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Kobe's ascension kind of mirrored that of the internet in that I think he turned pro in 96 and the internet was kind of just starting then. And, so for him to kind of grow right along with social media, I think he was, he was one of the first guys to get YouTube compilations, and he was such a great highlight basketball player. It's funny. I didn't have an emotional connection with Kobe either, in the sense that Kobe's about my age. And I remember those early and mid 20s years, I was working and grinding so hard, trying to like just make it and make a name for myself, that I kind of didn't have any time to care about what Kobe was doing or what was happening in the NBA. But I was aware of him, and I think just the unusualness of his persona, having grown up in Italy and speaking multiple languages and, you know, he was a unique figure on the sports landscape and really being unabashed about trying to fill the shoes of Jordan. You know, that was a goal of his, and he wanted to be the most famous Laker, and he did it all with one team. And there's a lot about his persona that was really fascinating. While, yeah, at the same time, like for me, I cried when Walter Payton died, mm-hmm. you know, and I was a young adult when that happened, but he was my guy. I mean, Payton was my childhood, and, you know, Jordan, like you said, was kind of your childhood too. And, you know, there was a heart level connection with those guys as a fan that wasn't there with Kobe. But I think what yesterday gave me an appreciation of is that for so many people, like even college basketball players at Union where I teach, like, they really, for whatever reason, had that heart level connection with Kobe. And I think he represented somebody who not only achieved a ton on the basketball court, but kind of had the persona and the business sense and the entertainment industry chops off the court that all these kids aspire to. You yeah. know, his career arc was one that they would all want. And, you know, they took it pretty hard as a result.
Well, yeah, and I think if you think about just the overlap of age ranges, so Kobe retired 2 years ago, I guess. So he retired mm-hmm. at 39 or 40, maybe. Yeah. And, you know, late in his career, he wasn't great anymore. He still put up numbers sometimes. Yeah. But if those guys became basketball fans at 7, 8 years old,
yeah,
they were catching Kobe during his title runs with Powell. You know, they missed the years of Kobe when he wore number 8 and he, you know, his hair was a little longer. He was sort of the young, super explosive guy. But they caught the, like, I'm going to take this game by the throat and choke the life out of it, Kobe, who was, he was one of the most feared and dominant players in the NBA for a good run during their, like, ages 8 through high school. Yep. So yeah, it makes sense. You know, I didn't have a heart connection to Jordan, but he was, you know, he was the NBA. I mean, his just aura was so big. So post Jordan, I was just Kevin Garnett. I was Kevin Garnett and Timberwolves. And so, you know, if this had been KG instead of Kobe, my reaction would have been similar to all of these people who were like, that's the guy who made me love this game. And it's the way I felt when Kirby Puckett died. I was like maybe in my early 20s when that happened. Yeah. And that was my childhood. Like, Kirby was my childhood guy. You know, he's the one who you'd do the over the fence catches and try to, you know, imitate his crazy stance and his hot kick. And he was short and chubby. And I used to be short and chubby. And there's just everything there. And so I kind of secondhand understand the resonance with so many people. But I heard a brief interview maybe with, I can't remember who it was because there was so many pieces of news floating around and commentary, but just a really heartfelt commentary from a younger basketball player. So maybe 10 years, Kobe's junior.
Yeah.
And he just, so I think an NBA guy now, if I recall, mm-hmm. and he was just saying there's no describing what it looks like when you are 10, 11, 12 years old and you look ahead and you see a black man who is owning the league, who mm-hmm. is owning business, who is respected, not just the, you know, the NBA has always had black superstars, but Kobe was a different guy because of his business acumen, because of his persona.
Yeah.
And so there's a cultural aspect to this that I suspect you and I both probably are on the outside of in terms of his meaningfulness to a huge number of basketball fans and just fans of Kobe.
Yeah, indeed. And I definitely understand it on a head level. You know, I understand it intellectually, but yeah, like knowing exactly what that feels like, I think we are on the outside of it. And, you know, he was such an interesting figure and so successful in all the ways that you just mentioned. You know, it would be hard not to, you know, to find that really compelling. And, you know, it's funny, as you were talking, I was reminded, I was trying to explain the Kobe, like, Mamba killer instinct thing to KK this morning, because we were driving home from the gym and obviously had spent 12 hours kind of saturated in Kobe reports and everything yesterday and this morning. And she was asking me like, well, how does he compare with LeBron and Jordan? And I was explaining this whole, you know, end of the game, stand on your neck, like you just need a finisher kind of moment, and how, you know, he really had that and he was really special in that way. And I think in a lot of ways, Pipe, not to put too much of a spiritual fine point on this, but Kobe was sort of the, in a way, an icon of secularism, right? I mean, the whole Mamba mentality, I'm going to take something and will it into existence. I mean, if you
he gave himself that nickname. Nobody nicknamed him that. He said, I am the Black Mamba, and just called himself that. And how many people have given themselves a nickname that then stuck?
Exactly.
Like there's a level of sort of intense insanity to that that echoes what you're saying.
So, yeah, if you don't know Christ at all, you know, Kobe is kind of the apex of what it can be, right? You know, you dream all this stuff into existence and you will it and you work it all into existence. And, you know, I think as we look back on his life, there were so many things that he was willing to make happen and so many dreams that he was able to live. In a Christless mindset, that is as good as it gets, you know, and there's even common grace in that on the level of you and I who know Christ really still being able to appreciate it and celebrate it and enjoy it. And, you know, you and I being athletes at some level, appreciators of sport, just really being able to appreciate what he brought to the table.
Yeah, the way that this conversation has gone and moving towards the more overtly spiritual aspects of it raises a question that I know you and I never like to talk about this stuff when it comes to sports, because we're a lover of the sport and the off the court field competitive side of things is of less interest to us.
Yeah.
How does Kobe's the rape allegations from when was that? Early 2000s? I can't remember exactly.
2003, I believe.
So, I mean, it was peak of his career. It was the Kobe Shaq era. And so he's accused of rape at a place in Colorado, and it ends up getting settled out of court. So a civil settlement. It doesn't get brushed under the rug per se, but it was pre-social media, which means that there wasn't the same level of like cancellation that there would be now of somebody.
Right.
But his wife stayed with him. Mm-hmm. They seem to have, by all accounts, reconciled and had a good family life. I don't know much about his marriage, but everything I've heard and read is you know, in terms of his devotion as a father, and they have stayed together. How does that whole arc of events play into your kind of how you consider Kobe?
Yeah, what a great question. You know, it's hard not to think about that without thinking about my wife. And it's interesting, too, in conversation with her, that was one of the first things she brought up, you know? So I think for a woman, it's different, right? So, and for KK, not being a sports person necessarily, but just getting little snatches and bits and pieces of sports narratives over the years through me, one of the first and most kind of loud things that she remembered about Kobe Bryant's life over the last 20 years was the rape allegation. And, you know, so for her, I think it's tougher to kind of compartmentalize that part of his life from everything else. And I mean, look, only God knows what happened. And really all we have as fans are the on-court moments. I don't think either of us were rushing to sort of put Kobe Bryant on any kind of a human pedestal as like, hey, children of ours, this is how you should be, you know? And I think were Kobe alive and were it a conversation point with our kids, we would even be slow to, you know, celebrate his hunger for success and his need for validation. And there are all these things spiritually that you would kind of give pause to, you know, So yeah, I don't know, Pipe. To answer your question, it's really hard to separate the two. And
yeah.
I wanna both celebrate the idea that in Christ there is forgiveness for sins and there is new life, right? So there is an opportunity in the gospel for the old man to die and for reconciliation to happen. Whether that happened in his life or his marriage, I have no idea. I hope so. You know, I really hope so. And the fact that a marriage could survive something like that and reconciliation could seemingly happen is hopeful. But if something happened, it doesn't negate it either, you know? So it's kind of this both and thing where you go, man, I really hope that played out in the right way. I kind of doubt it, but I still hope it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's hard to know how to make sense out of these things outside of a context where the gospel is the thing that reconciles.
Right.
Because what is reconciliation outside of that? I mean, I think
right.
If you believe in common grace, you know, the image bearing of God and mm-hmm. the fingerprints of God, very obvious in people. I think people do godly things without awareness of God. So yeah. It's very possible that there was a genuine forgiveness and a genuine reconciliation. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me to understand exactly what that would mean. I think the part of it that probably spins up in my head the most, I'm at the point now where if there are allegations of something and I don't know what happened,
yeah,
making accusations, making postulations just mm-hmm. seems foolish and more, you know, gossipy and harmful than anything. Like, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened in that case. I also don't know what happened between Kobe and his wife in the, you know, almost 20 years since. But it does make me think a lot about what she must be experiencing now in the wake of his passing. Lost a daughter, lost her husband, who ostensibly, if they stayed together, a lot of work was done to put things back together. Because how else do you stay together for 17 more years aside from, you know, a real dying to self and work being done? And I mean, I guess people do it in a miserable way, but that in today's culture, that seems unlikely. Most people tap out.
Yeah.
So if, man, where does that leave her? I don't, you know, again, with no idea. That's not a question for you to answer. Just the question that is in my, you know, kind of in my mind and heart is where does this leave her as somebody who seemingly sacrificed and gave and worked and and that's setting aside the inexpressible pain of losing a child.
Yeah. No, definitely. And I think, isn't it interesting how death makes everything else seem a little bit silly in light of it, in the sense that nobody in his family or in his immediate circle is comforting themselves with, yeah, but he scored 60 points against the Jazz in his last game, or we won an Oscar, or he had this really unique show on ESPN. So all the things that we, and when I say we, I mean you and I and Ron and people like us, we beat our brains out and we work so hard to get these things, these earthly things, that the minute someone dies, they really do seem ridiculous in light of eternity. And I think there's a lesson there for us. If his marriage survived because of Christ, then man, that's worth celebrating. I think it's probably because of Christ in a common grace context that his marriage survived at all.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, there are laudable things in this. But I do wonder if the whole narrative gives some perspective on, you know, you hate to say what's important because that's so cliche, but you know, to me, appreciating my kids, you know, hungering for more time with them, because we do know how fleeting this is, you know, and it could all be over in a heartbeat. So, you know, really wanting to soak up, to appreciate, to spend a little bit less time on my persona or even my career or whatever it is that I'm chasing, you know, because it all seems pretty small in light of the loss of life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up persona, because I think one of the things yesterday, like, I just had to kind of set my phone aside and walk away from everything public for a bit in the afternoon, and then, you know, turned on the Grammys in the evening, because I was like, I need to put my mind somewhere else. Because of the persona work being done, built on the back of Kobe Bryant's passing. And it was so... This is not accusing everybody who said something about it of that. It's pretty obvious the difference between a man who I respected for his basketball talent passed away, I'm heartbroken, or the best wishes towards the family. And the people who are sort of, they're writing immediate posts. There's a just self-posturing attitude of it. And I wonder if people even know they're doing it, or is it just the, like, everything is an opportunity to be heard?
Yeah.
You know, because and here's the thing. I was tempted to do the same thing. I probably wrote 3 to 5 tweets and then either deleted them or just, you know, put them in my drafts and I'll delete them later. Because I was like, this is not the time and place to talk, like, for me to give my opinion on Kobe's legacy. Who cares? Who cares what I think? I mean, I realize we're talking about it on the podcast, but this feels like a conversation with friends as opposed to
a
public, you know, platforming of something.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's really interesting that you share that. And it's hopeful to me that you deleted the tweets, you know? And I think the pathology that you just described is as natural as breathing for people in this context. And to your question of whether it's even conscious, I don't think it is. You know, I think it would take a massive amount of, like, mind and heart work on a day-to-day basis to extricate, like, personal motive from public persona. And all the more true if there's any kind of fame involved, right? So regardless of how big your audience is, something happens, whether it's Kobe Bryant dying or, you know, at Jared C. Wilson drops an article that you don't entirely agree with or whatever. And it's impossible to separate how is this going to move my career forward from just a person having a genuine reaction, which is why, like, for me, it would 100% be sinful for me to be on Twitter. Like, I would sin every day. Because I struggle with that, right? And I struggle with wanting everyone to like me and wanting to move my persona forward and all these things. And I would have almost certainly written the wrong thing yesterday if I'd had access to Twitter. And I would have woken up feeling gross and convicted about it. And so I'm just glad that wasn't an issue. And I think in general, it would be good for more people to say less things, because Kobe Bryant is going to be remembered in this kind of massive way, regardless of what I say about it or regardless of what you say about it. And, you know, yeah, I agree, Pipe. There was kind of a gross amount of posturing. And so here's one that I'm trying to get my head around. And again, I don't want to judge anybody for doing this necessarily, but there was a lot of, like, here's a picture of me with Kobe kind of posts from other famous people. And yeah, that to me felt a little self-congratulatory. I don't know. Hard to separate the two.
It is. And I think because it's subconscious for people, it's probably not fair to, you know, to throw stones at their motives.
Sure.
Think it's the only way people know how to process difficult things. You know,
right.
We talked about this when the Notre Dame Cathedral burned.
Yeah.
The people who are pulling out this, like, this is tragic, this is whatever. First of all, I bet most of those people have forgotten that it burned. Since then. Now, I don't think the life of somebody is going to have that little impact on people, but sort of the pulling of yourself into the grieving process, like, this is my grief. Well, it's not your grief. Yeah. It is, there's different kinds of grief. The family deserves to have their grief, which is very different than mine or yours or somebody who was a massive fan of his. Yeah. And in that case, it's a shared thing, but it's also like, social media is not the place to process the hardest things in life.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's part of the reason I felt compelled to kind of put my phone away, because I felt the draw to start to process this thing in a way that felt increasingly trite.
Yeah,
every word I wrote was just meaningless for two reasons. One, I'm not the right person to say things about Kobe's legacy. There are people who knew him. There are people who covered him as a reporter or as a friend. There's his agent. There's his family. There's a lot of people who were in a circle who had a right to do that. I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
And the second is, it's death. Death processed publicly like that. Not just publicly, but in that platform is just it. That's the same platform that we process our great tacos and signing a book contract and
or our sweet trips or whatever,
and six ways to be a better man, and like you have kind of amalgamated death into all the meaningless or just less meaningful stuff of life. And I love Twitter,
but
Twitter is useful for there's a ceiling on its usefulness and its appropriateness, and I just I don't know, it feels to me that people only know how to process that way. The idea of putting down their phone and just sitting and reflecting, thinking, considering, like, what must Vanessa Bryant be feeling right now?
Yeah. Or like processing that with whoever's in your living room. Yeah. You know, if you're fortunate enough to have someone in your space, like, I mean, I remember when my grandpa died, I was 13 and like you weep, you know, you heave with grief, and you get held by whoever's close by, and that it's a private thing. But I think this discussion reveals a lot about what different people think about Twitter, right? Like, to me, and what I hear you saying, even though you have a higher view of Twitter than me, we're both in agreement that responding to it on Twitter trivializes it in a sense, because Twitter is a trivial place, right? And if we had a higher view of Twitter, we may think differently about that. Whereas, like, I will probably read the eulogy that the New York Times puts together, because that feels less trivial to me. And it feels like, okay, somebody worked on this and somebody thought about it. And it's not just somebody kind of knee jerk jumping on a persona wagon subconsciously. I think just watching TV about it yesterday, and they did the very now thing of like running everybody's tweets on TV. I think the ones that resonated the most were the ones that were just like, oh no, you know, not this, not Kobe. That felt genuine, you know, and heartfelt and kind of in the moment. But I don't even like being in a position, though, where I have to judge the veracity of someone's response. You know what I mean? And being alive in 2020 kind of puts us in that place of having to sift through all of it, for one, but then also having to judge it. And it's just a lot. It's a lot to have to deal with.
And that's the thing, is I think when you say judging, I don't hear you saying like that you are the judge and jury over this, but just
no.
Even being put in a position to evaluate it.
You know,
the moment somebody says something, you're in a position where you have to go, you kind of at a gut level as well as an intellectual level, going, is this genuine? Is this true? What are they trying to communicate?
Yeah.
Which is very different than, the person in your living room who's just working through something, saying something to they don't have the words, or they're crying or whatever it is. And it just, I don't know.
Well, that's the corner, though, that Twitter has backed us into, in that it's it's rewired our brains to do that, right? Because on a normal Twitter day where nobody dies, you know, and it's just the same people arguing about the same stuff, like what you're doing when you're scrolling is high speed judging, right? You're like, I'm going to stop and give a little time to this tweet, or I'm going to like sniff and roll my eyes at that tweet or whatever. Right. So we're all high speed, you know, judges in mm-hmm. the sense that Twitter has rewired our brains to be that way. And, you know, when somebody dies or when something truly monumental happens, like it did yesterday, you know, it's hard to unplug that thing that we do or, you know, shut off that muscle so that we can sit in it and give it the space it requires.
Yeah. And I think there's also just, I was just thinking about this because I was trying to figure out how hypocritical I am, you know, as we're talking. Because
yeah, for sure.
You know, I'm saying things and I'm wondering how much have I done on Twitter that completely flies in the face of the words that are coming out of my mouth right now. And I realized, you know, I posted publicly about getting engaged. So mm-hmm. that's a personal, private thing that I took public. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here thinking, is that different? Or am I just self-justifying? Here's my thought process on this, and you can tell me if I'm full of crap.
Yeah.
Is first, that wasn't a public thing. That was expressed to family. Some family members were present, some were notified and you know, celebrated with very quickly thereafter before anything went public, close friends, things like that. And I think there's a difference between celebration and grief publicly. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. allowing people into your joy is a little different than what feels like posturing your grief. Because grief, because of this age of faux authenticity, genuine celebration feels authentic always. When you watch people celebrate, it always feels authentic. This is somebody who is grateful, who is happy, who's whatever.
Yeah.
Grief and pain are leveraged often.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so public grief and pain require, it seems like, a different sort of evaluation of what are you expecting from me? I don't know you, but like, do you want a digital hug? Like, mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a snide way, but just in a, I think there's a different aspect to it. So, well, there's my initial set of thoughts. What strikes you?
Yeah, no, that's really good. And I think what strikes me is, you know, to the note about, you know, you announcing your engagement on Twitter, to me, that fits into a very different category than, let's say it's 3 years from now and you've been married for a while and you're posting pictures, the subtext of which is basically, look at my amazing marriage. To me, that's a lot more self-aggrandizing and posturing and persona building and aggravating than someone basically sharing happy news on the internet, right? Like, so you're announcing your engagement shared via Twitter. It served a news sharing function, right? In mm-hmm. that, you do have a bit of a public platform and you also just are someone who has a lot of friends, and that's a blessing. And it's a way to tell everybody that you didn't have time to personally text on the night of your engagement, which is a pretty monumental night. So, you know, I don't think anybody's begrudging you announcing an engagement on Twitter, but I think the things that I hear people and the things that I got the most jealous of, aggravated by, et cetera, on social media were the things that felt like I'm taking this moment in my life that should be private, like having coffee on a porch with my wife, and I'm turning it into a public occasion for people to look at my life and celebrate it, right? Those are the things that piss me off the most about social media. And when people do that, I will almost always get pissed off. But yeah, I think the response to something like a engagement is completely different, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that does. And that even helps me in kind of thinking through what I feel at my gut level, but maybe hadn't processed through. And I completely agree that there's a there's a difference in news sharing and sell. I mean, it's the difference between announcing a new baby and announcing, you know, something that looks like you're congratulating yourself on being a great parent.
Yeah.
If somebody is excited about having a new baby, that feels like an absolute occasion to rejoice. Or if your child has been really sick and the doctor declares them, you know, cancer free or something, like, yes, 100% celebrate those things. Those are different things than, you know, was reading Bible story number 87 for the day with my kid, and listen, he can quote, you know, Romans from the Latin Vulgate or something. And and so there's, I think I resonate with what you're saying. And the flip side of that on the grief is, because of the unassailability of authenticity, if somebody claims authenticity, we can't say anything to them.
Yeah.
You know, that's their truth. Those are their feelings. And so grief allows things to be handled very differently, and people sort of use social media as their therapist, as their friends, as the things that ought to be handled in a, handled in a relational context. I don't want to say private, because that makes it sound like they're, you know, dirty secrets, but a safe relational context versus a public judged context.
Well, and isn't it such a counterfeit version of all those things that you've described? I mean, essentially you're describing, at one level, the life of the church, right? Like, I have brothers and sisters in this life with whom I'm sharing everything, right? Good things, bad things, triumphs, struggles, you know, and this happening within the context of a family and then a set of friendships and then the church. Like, again, I'm just reminded of the richness that we have in Christ, you know, and it's not accidental that, you know, these things happen in a really rich level in the life of the church. But if you don't have that, and if all you have is the world, then 100%, you know, you're looking for your therapy, your validation, your whatever on Twitter. And that to me is deeply sad. Again, not in a judgmental way, but just in a, man, I wish it was better.
It seems lonely. You know,
it does. It seems lonely, but noisy. You know what I'm saying? Which is the worst way to be lonely. Like, if I'm going to be lonely, I at least want it to be quiet so that I can kind of parse my own thoughts accordingly. But
yeah, that's really true. I mean, it feels, when I can think back on the loneliest moments of my life, none of them were sitting by myself at home.
Yeah.
They were all in public places where I saw other people living life, and I felt like mine was very removed from that. So, I mean, sometimes it was church, sometimes it was, you know, a restaurant, sometimes, you know, traveling when I used to travel for work more. But those always, like, airports always felt the most sort of depressingly lonely to me at those times.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just watch people in those contexts. So, yeah, like, loud loneliness is so depressing.
Oh, it really is. It's the worst kind, I think. And you know, to take it back to Kobe a little bit, I think one of the most, and I don't know why this struck me as hopeful, and I want to hear your response to this, but one of the most hopeful images of yesterday was, like, everybody congregating around the Staples Center, as the images of Kobe flashed on the big screens outside the Staples Center. It felt less lonely to me. And I looked at that and I went, yeah, better for people to be out there and be kind of shoulder to shoulder than to be, you know, just thumbing away at their phones all afternoon, trying to make sense of it, you know?
And not to compare the two tragedies, but just in terms of the response to it, I was a freshman in college when 9/11 happened, and, you know, I was at Wheaton. And so, you know, Christian school really believes in the Bible and in prayer. And so when that happened, later that day, you know, they canceled classes, and they had multiple prayer services throughout the day, or just not even prayer services, but, like, opportunities to come together and pray and grieve and be afraid and whatever. And there was such a richness in being side by side, shoulder to shoulder with people who, I mean, some of these people I'd known for 2 weeks, because I'd only been at college since, you know, late August. And that's responding to something publicly painful that way is so much different. Now, I'm imagining if I had had Twitter then, what would it have looked like? The relative isolation of people responding to this on Instagram, on Twitter, on, you know, pick your favorite social media platform versus 2,000 students sort of it spontaneously flooding to the auditorium because that's what you do when stuff is this bad.
Well, and it's what you're describing is the difference between being in college now and being in college in a pre-social media environment. And those of us who are in the college business, we talk about this a lot, right? And the conversations are for you probably similar in the service to the church context that you're in now professionally. But yeah, there is this kind of like pulling out of our hair over the fact that it's hard to get people to come together for anything anymore, right? Because we're all in our own privately curated worlds of electronics. And, you know, it's hard to get anybody to leave their dorms and come to something. And yeah, sometimes it takes a tragedy of a huge magnitude to get people to do that. And it's really interesting to me, Pipe, that more and more we talk about life in these terms. Like, remember how it was to get a book deal before Twitter? And now, like, you get a book deal and you're posting a picture of the contract or a picture of when your books arrive. And it's like, for me, stuff like that falls into a category of, yeah, I kind of roll my eyes about it. You know, when people do that, I sniff and roll my eyes a little bit, but I also get it. You know, I expect authors to do that. And I expect even my friends to do it. But that doesn't mean I like it. You know, I think it was richer. I think it was better to get a book deal and, I don't know, just hug your wife or like call your best buddy from college and be like, hey, listen to this. You're not going to believe this. You know, and there was a sweetness and an innocence to that that I think we've lost completely.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we have no categories anymore for what used to, I think, be very natural. This is a family matter. This is a friend's matter. This is a neighbor's matter. This is a church matter. This is a citywide matter. This is a, you know, write an op-ed matter.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there are benefits to the easy access to putting everything public. There are definite benefits. I mean, I wouldn't be on social media if I didn't think it was beneficial in some way.
Yeah.
But there's a cost to it as well in terms of just the, what is appropriate where, what is appropriate when. You know, I've had conversations with a couple friends where I'm like, dude, social media is not your diary. You know, like every private thought doesn't need to end up there.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's not more genuine or honest or authentic. It's just honest or authentic or genuine because these are good hearted people just pointing it in the wrong direction. You know, like that's a conversation we should have over drinks. That's a conversation to have with your small group or your buddies or kind of whoever that circle is.
Yeah.
And we've lost categories for that, which is why I think there is sort of there was a kind of a simple, painful beauty to the gathering at the Staples Center of Lakers fans in memoriam to Kobe. And, you know, I saw a couple of interviews and just the Kobe owned Los Angeles.
Yeah. Like,
real Los Angelinos, not necessarily all the transports, but the people who are like, this is my city. I've been a Lakers. My dad was a Lakers fan when they moved here from Minneapolis kind of thing.
And,
and so there's something there that you look at and you're like, oh, that's community. There's real humanity there.
Well, and he kind of gave that to LA in a way. Like, he kind of gave LA a person, you know, whereas before LA was to me was always like the ultimate collective, right? It was the place you moved to pursue a career in entertainment, basically. And as such, people were from everywhere else. And LA, even as good as Magic was, and even as good as the Showtime Lakers were, you know, there were always football teams moving in and out of LA in that era. And LA was really like Kobe was their first long-term celebrity, for lack of a better term, you know. And there have been always, obviously, movie stars moving in and out of L.A. and bands and stuff like that. But he was the – for 20 years, he was a Laker, you know, and he was a Laker the whole way. And I think basketball is unique, Pipe, in that you really – if you watch a lot of games, you sit with the stars for a long time. Like, you see their faces 82 nights a year, you know, and – Baseball,
and in Kobe's case, it was like 100 plus nights a year because of how deep they went in the playoffs over and over and over again.
And there's only five guys on the floor for your team at one time. So you're seeing their faces. You're seeing them up close. It's the most personal sport, and it's the most personality saturated sport by a long shot. And I think that combined with LA kind of needing their own person, he was the guy, you know, and that made him special. So yeah, you're 100% right. Seeing people together outside the Staples Center, it was a hopeful thing.
The other thing is, he was a unique fit for Los Angeles because he did have that eclectic background of, you know, he's a black guy. His father played in the league, but his father also played overseas. So he was, was kind of a multicultural background. Highly educated, also, you know, grew up, you know, playing in Philly. And so when he gets to Los Angeles, he's got the hard edge of your Allen Iversons to a degree. But there's not a group in LA that he can't walk into the room and be respected by those who own studios and the movie producers and the big wigs of the actors. Like, he's not less than anybody in anybody's eyes. And that's and, you know, saying that, I realize I'm, you know, touching on some sensitive subjects of race and social class and things like that. But people are jerks. And so we have those problems. And in a lot of ways, Kobe just kicked those lines and just smudged them out and said, no, I'm here and I'm there. And I'm, you know, I can be in all these contexts, which uniquely enabled him, I think, to make Los Angeles his own. That and winning a bunch.
Oh, sure, man. And that's fascinating, right? I mean, that makes him compelling. And he has more access to people in LA than you or I will ever have, right? Regardless of his race or ours. And it makes everything that he did so impressive, you know? And it's, again, whether you know Christ or not, it's impossible not to be impressed by what he was able to make happen, you know, and you and I at a much smaller level are in businesses of making things happen, right? We want to make book deals happen and we want to have a good live show in April. And, you know, we have other projects that we're trying to make pop. And I think his ability to make things happen and what's more, his ability to do it in his own way, like, he didn't want to just be a talking head in a studio after his career. He wanted to make this really kind of unique, weird, mold-breaking ESPN show, and he did his animated stuff. And
he's coming out with a line of kids' books, and just he was a Renaissance man in a very unironic way of using that term.
Oh, most definitely, and very unique in terms of even the post-athletic storylines that we're comfortable with, you know what I mean? Ex-jock retires, you know, gets celebrated for a year or two, ends up back in the booth. You know, we're comfortable with that narrative because we've seen it happen so many times, but he was unique even in retirement, you know, in terms of what he was able to make happen. So sad stuff, man. Sad stuff. Any other kind of parting thoughts on Kobe before we wrap this one, Pipe?
No, I mean, I think we've touched on, I mean, there's always more to be said about a person's life, but, I think that what I would want to end with, since we've touched on so much serious stuff, is just one of the things that I was reminded of yesterday is just how unbelievable he was at basketball.
Yeah.
Because I only remember the last couple of years when he was not as good. Mm-hmm. But going back and looking, he was ridiculous. And just I don't think he's one of the top, five or 10 players ever, but he's one of the top like two or three shooting guards ever. And
yeah.
And when he was at his peak, he was unbelievable and did really make watching basketball in the late 90s and early 2000s incredibly fun. Like I remember watching Kings Lakers series and Blazers Lakers, back when it was the Jailblazers and, Timberwolves Lakers, the 1 year the Timberwolves made it very far in the playoffs and hating Kobe as a player. Yeah. Never personal, just loathing him, which is a sign of respect. Just because I was like, oh, he's doing it again, that guy.
Yeah.
So, it feels trite in some ways, but remembering his just insane ability is something that I'm like, we haven't really talked about that. He was one of the best, certainly of his generation.
Dude, I honestly think that's the opposite of trite, in that was his job. Right. I mean, his job was to be that guy at a high level, and that's what he wanted. And the fact that we remember him as such, I think it's true. It's the opposite of trite. Like for me, I agree 100% with everything you said. And also he was a guy that could like change the temperature of the gym, and this is another thing I was trying to explain to my wife this morning, kind of the Kobe versus LeBron thing where LeBron was always impressive, right? Like freaky physical attributes, all the stuff that's been well documented, his ability to score, involve his teammates, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like Kobe, whenever he wanted, he could walk into any gym and own it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like turn the fan base and flip the mood. And, that game where he never shot, like, he was basically like, let me show you how bad all my teammates are and why you need me to shoot a whole bunch. Like, it was petulant and petty, but I mean, it was him just kind of owning the moment in a way that it seemed like he always could do it. And I will always be interested in a performer who can do that, regardless of their vocation.
Yeah, and just the sort of savage dislike between he and Shaq. And I realize there was probably some personal stuff to that, but just Shaq was a lot like LeBron in that he showed up and he goes, well, I'm probably the best guy here because who's going to stop me?
Yeah.
And Kobe he sort of absorbed that tenacity that Jordan had, where it's almost psychotic. Mm-hmm. And so he just couldn't stand that Shaq wouldn't go harder all the time. Shaq could have been one of the top two or three players ever, and instead he's one of the top, 12 because he just didn't try all the time and he played himself into shape and he was amazing. But that mentality of Kobe's where he just every minute on the court mattered, never took it professional aggressiveness and focus almost insanity, which again, maybe it's commendable, but at the very least, the results were there.
Yeah, the results were there and it was noticeable. Pipe, great to talk with you about this. It's, I don't want to say fun, but like, it's enriching to talk with a Christian friend who understands sports when something like this happens. And, this is the opposite of, trying to capture it in a tweet. I mean, it took us an hour. We could go another hour. I don't know how right we were in any of this, but to me, it sure was something that I appreciate, and part of what's fun about doing this show is we get to do this with a whole bunch of topics kind of on a spectrum from trivial to meaningful. And it's just really good to be able to do it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in terms of being right, I feel like one of the advantages of a conversation like this is I don't think either of us necessarily came in with takes as much as we did reactions.
Yep.
Which I think, especially when you're talking about tragedy, that's how you process through. You sort of go with, this is how this struck me. And then you kind of work it out. And so, an hour to work it out is way better than 280 characters or whatever we get on Twitter.
Amen, man. Most definitely. Well, Pipe, take us out with a little promo of our live event in Louisville, something we're looking forward to. We always enjoy the three of us being in the same room together, but being in the same room as our audience. So tell us about what that's going to look like.
Yeah, so we're coming up on, is this our fourth? It's our fourth live event or fifth?
I think so.
I think it's our fourth. Yeah. And so, yeah, April 13, it's a Monday. It's the Monday after Easter and the Monday before Together for the Gospel in Louisville.
Yep.
We are doing our fourth live event. We're calling it Live at Midtown. It's at Sojourn Midtown in Louisville. All of the details are at happyrantpodcast.com. That is updated, and you can find the link there. But it'll be same basic format as we've done before. We're working on some curveballs to keep things interesting, keep you on your toes if you're there or if you're just listening to the recordings after the fact. It'll be at 7 p.m. That's Eastern time, so 7 to 10 p.m. We'll record a couple episodes and then do Q&A with our audience, which I think I speak for Ted and Ronnie is our favorite part of the whole thing, is just getting a chance to answer questions, interact with you great listeners who show up. Tickets are $15. We will probably run some, you know, limited time discounts here and there, some contests to get free tickets or different things in the couple months leading up to it. But seating is limited. So if you want to reserve your spot, go to happyrantpodcast.com. You'll see it right in the middle of the page, live event. We may also be able to work it out with Red Bud Coffee to have some of their delicious roasts there. If you're interested in getting that before April, go to redbudcoffee.com, check out what they've got. And if you use the code HAPPYRANT, one word, HAPPYRANT, at checkout, you can get 10% off your purchase from Redbud as well.
I love it. Looking forward to that pipe. And enjoy chatting today, man. Excellent work. And we've not done what we always do. We usually don't spend an hour on one topic, but it felt it felt appropriate, and I'm glad we did. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Often we believe our questions mean we don't have faith, but I believe Jesus loves our questions. Our questions are windows into heaven. I'm Caden Fabrizio, and on the Questions with Caden podcast, we ask and answer one question per episode as relevantly and biblically as possible. Questions about fear, anxiety, depression, addiction, and so much more. Don't worry, your questions, they're not going to scare Jesus, so ask away. Listen and subscribe now at lifeaudio.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.